this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Turbines Trigger Turf Wars. Amazon's wind farm flares resentment among neighbors in small eastern North Carolina community. And that's the headline on the front page. The actual story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline. Is the Amazon wind farm project the last of its kind in North Carolina? And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Armed with hard hats, cranes, and elaborate pulley systems, crews at the Amazon wind farm near Elizabeth City are hoisting massive cylinders into the sky. By the end of the year, 104 of these giant white columns, located on 22,000 acres, each armed with 182-foot blades, will be generating more than 200 megawatts of power for e-commerce giant Amazon, enough to power 61,000 homes and effectively changing a landscape long dominated by corn stalks and soybeans. But in the shadows of the spinning giants, a quixotic duel may be brewing as farmers and neighbors in Pasquotank and Perquimans counties face off over the project. On one side stands corn farmers such as 67-year-old Horace Pritchard, who is set to profit from the wind farm. On the other stands landowners such as Jillian Gigi Badawi, who claims she had 900 individuals who have signed a petition decrying the project. Badawi's property is less than 1 mile from a planned turbine, but she has never visited the site. And yet she says, I'm fine with it if it's in a desert somewhere, not near people and not near birds. While it's likely too late for Badawi, conditional use permits have long been approved and an attempt to squash them in court went against her in June. It may not be too late for her cohorts who even now are protesting similar projects trying to gain footing in the eastern part of the state. Over the past few weeks, legislators announced a bill that proponents say could halt the industry in the state even before wind hits the first propeller. Windfall. In 2009, when Pritchard first started talking with Iberdrola, the Spanish wind farm giant building the project, corn was $5 to $6 per bushel, he says. Today, it's below $4, and it's been down below $3, Pritchard says. So when Iberdrola's director of business development, Craig Poff, said he could provide a steady stream of supplemental income by leasing farmland for turbines, I didn't hesitate. I said, let's talk, Pritchard says, as did about 59 of his fellow farmers who, according to the lease deal, will be paid about $5,000 annually for each turbine Iberdrola builds on their land. Pritchard, a fourth-generation farmer, controls more than 1,000 of those acres, but to his neighbor, Badawi, who bought her house in 2012, all this was done hastily and without community input. I'm a process person, she says. There's no process here. Badawi, however, lost an argument in court just days ago, possibly extinguishing any chance of putting a halt to the project. To many, the Amazon project may have been perceived as not being feasible, especially given its scope, size, and duration. Delay at the start. Teresa Hurdle lives one house closer to the farm, and she says she heard about the project from a neighbor. That was in 2011, around the time public hearings happened and around the time a conditional use permit was granted. Economic developers, backed up by public documents, say they weren't receiving much pushback from citizens over the project back then. By the time the opposition emerged, it was too late, as the conditional use permit had not only been granted but also extended. Once a developer receives a conditional use permit, it's pretty much at their discretion as to when they begin work, explains Pasquotank Planning Director Shelley Cox. But it was that delay from the permit in 2011 to the groundbreaking in 2015 that had landowners thinking the project had fizzled. Nothing was happening. Then all of a sudden it's ramping up again, Badawi says. Several factors accounted for the delay. Iberdrola's Poff, who first brought the idea to Pasquotank planning officials in 2009, says drops in natural gas prices delayed the project, but the biggest factor was locating a buyer. Along with finding land and a way to transmit the power, the site is next to two substations. Finding a customer is a top concern. So while Hurdle and other landowners say they were living their lives, 48-year-old Poff and his team were reaching out to utility players. And commissioners with little pushback. A landowner expressed concerns about rattlesnakes during a public hearing about the project. We're extending the deadline for Iberdrola to break ground. The vitriol that's arisen over the last few months was absent from those early public meetings, records show. There were a lot of questions, Wayne Harris, Director of Economic Development for Pasquotank, recalls. We had never done anything like this before in this area. But that's all they were, he insists. Just questions. Questions about noise, questions about shadow flicker, the shadow created by turbine blades rotating in front of sunlight, and questions about what would happen if Iberdrola decided to pull out of the project when the lease expires. To mitigate the last issue, commissioners required Iberdrola to secure a $1 million bond to be evaluated every 5 years to ensure they'll be able to remove the turbines after the lease term ends. Selling clean energy. Poff, who says a fishing trip tipped him off to eastern North Carolina's wind potential, thought the questions had been answered. Poff is in charge of a wide swath of area for Iberdrola, from Pennsylvania through the southeast, and says he's constantly evaluating the next opportunity, but he's never met with pushback like this before. Talk to Poff long enough, and one gets a sense that the internal squabble among neighbors is foreign to him. But he continues to stay on message. Look at what we're doing compared to coal plants, he pans. And from an environmental standpoint, that may be true. Wind turbines don't produce atmospheric emissions that cause greenhouse gases. In North Carolina alone, coal produced 46.6 million metric tons of carbon dioxide in 2013, according to a 2015 report by the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Other residents were concerned about aviation support. In addition to crop dusters spraying cornfields, forest fires have brought aviation support to the region over the past few years, the North Carolina Forest Service confirms. Both the turbines and the METs, or Meteorological Evaluation Towers, can be flight hazards, confirms Federal Aviation Administration spokesman Ken Degg. And Brian Haynes, spokesman for the North Carolina Forest Service, says turbines limit his department's use of planes and helicopters for fire response. It will be our job to make sure all concerns for wildfire protection in and around these areas are identified and addressed, Haynes says, adding that it's no different than with other tall structures. Legislative pushback. But there's one concern about turbines that developers haven't been able to shake, fear that the structures could interfere with military training flight paths. While a new bill, even with its title, Military Operations Protection Act of 2016, purports to be about protecting the state's military footprint, it does include requirements aimed at civilians, such as a passage that would have developers study noise and shadow flicker impact, as well as to notify surrounding property owners. One of the biggest proponents is Senator Harry Brown, Republican Jones Onslow, who helped rewrite a 2-page House bill into a 22-page legislation. He says that while the Department of Defense already reviews developers' plans to determine compatibility with requirements and installations, they don't evaluate the likelihood that the project may result in an eventual decision by a BRAC, Base Closure and Realignment Commission, BRAC, board that a mission set is better served at an installation outside North Carolina due to encroachment or private development projects. Federal agencies are not charged with putting the strategic economic needs of North Carolina first. That is the job of the North Carolina General Assembly, Brown adds. Brown says the intent of turbine restrictions in the bill is to ensure the training and low-level flight routes around the installations aren't compromised by tall structures, including wind turbines, that could interfere with already established training routes and patterns. Maggie Clark, Director of Government Affairs for Raleigh-based advocacy group North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association, says it's an unnecessary bill, as many of the military concerns are addressed in other legislation. She points to existing requirements that require base commanders and major military installations to be consulted on projects, as well as the U.S. Department of Defense permitting process that she calls very strict. She calls the provisions in the bill confusing and unnecessary and predicts that if they become law, the legislation will likely lead to lawsuits. The bill adds layers of red tape and procedure that will discourage developers from engaging in business in North Carolina, she says. This bill could bring great harm to some of the state's poorest counties that are seeing hundreds of millions of dollars in wind investment. Economic impact. And it's not just the direct investment from Iberdrola. About 250 construction jobs are already boosting Pasquotank and Perquimans counties. While at least half come from outside of the area, according to POF, they're providing what Harris calls a big burst of revenue. Since construction began last year, room tax revenues have risen 30% year over year in Pasquotank as construction workers fill hotel rooms surrounding the site. And local retail numbers are outperforming national trends. Since Elizabeth City, unlike other coastal towns, doesn't really have a tourism economy, he credits it all to the Amazon project. In addition, landowner payments and taxes for the first phase of the project are expected to inject $1.1 million into the local economy each year, including more than $500,000 in tax revenue. According to a release from the state. While that burst is just during the construction of the turbines, only 10 positions will work full-time at the site in the next few years. There are two big long-term benefits. The one most important to Pritchard is the more than 60 miles of roads Iberdrola has built and is committed to maintaining for the next 25 years. Previously, one of the timber paths winding through his cornfields was referred to as Slick Road, impassable in inclement weather. An estimate that he and other farmers put together for stabilizing just a few of the timber pathways with rock came out to about $5 million. We can't afford that, no way, he says. Bigger plans. POF says he's eyeing additional locations across the southeast, and economic developers say they've heard from officials in other parts of the country that are curious about the process. For Iberdrola, it's also a big deal, and not just in terms of the revenue gleaned from selling hundreds of megawatts of power to Amazon. It's the first time Iberdrola has sold power in this way, as it typically deals with utility companies as customers. If it's successful, it could open up an entirely new revenue stream for Iberdrola. POF says the addition of the Amazon name has added a lot of acclaim to the project, an added boost in what's becoming a unique public relations campaign. Jonathan Naughton, director of the University of Wyoming's Wind Energy Research Center, says Amazon is following in the footsteps of companies such as Google, which also buys power from wind farms. It's a totally new buyer, he says. The idea of a company purchasing power directly is new. These very data-intensive companies that have a large electric footprint do not want to be known as having a large CO2 footprint, so they're being very active. And that means opportunity for North Carolina, but only if the state is willing to take it. While the bill currently cycling in Raleigh won't impact the Amazon project, the bill could stop equally bullish plans to the south. An Apex clean energy project dubbed Timber Mill Wind could straddle parts of Perquimans and Chowan counties, parts that would come into conflict with the boundaries of the bill. Frank Heath, the Perquimans County Manager, who has been working with a developer on the project, says the bill would certainly make it more difficult to develop projects. And that sits just fine with the 46-year-old Badawi, who says, "There's nothing they could do to change my mind," she says. "None of this is right." And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by digital producer Mark DeRoberts. The first headline: How Rufty Turned His Ace Into an Act of Generosity. To John Rufty, the game of golf is just that, a game that you play with friends and family. But at a Cary Chamber of Commerce event about 2 weeks ago at the Prestonwood Country Club, the game of golf changed forever for Rufty, owner of Rufty Homes, the custom home builder for the millionaires in the Triangle. He had a hole-in-one and won a $40,000 Buick convertible. It was the number two hole at the Meadows course in Prestonwood. I actually had quit hitting my tee ball for a while because my shoulder was hurting, Rufty says. But when I saw they were giving away a car, I had to try it. Rufty recalls hitting the 167-yard shot with a 5-wood to the back of the right bunker, then watching it jump onto the green and then start rolling, only to disappear from sight. Rufty thought the ball went over the green until they saw a tournament spotter confirm the ball was in the hole. But what made Biz write this little nugget was because of what Rufty did afterwards. I lost my dad to cancer, and I am in the process of losing my mom to cancer as well, he says. So I just donated the car to the Jimmy V Foundation with hopes that results from all the cancer research will someday save millions of lives. Well played, sir. Our HO exec forwards Cleft Lip Group's mission. When Durham Contract Research Organization, ROE, Incorporated, or RHO, and its co-CEO, Russ Helms, decided to serve as the 2016 title sponsor for the 9th annual Smile Train Triathlon, it came from the heart. Perhaps Biz needs to lay out a bit of background about the event and about Helms. Smile Train is an international children's charity centered on a single problem, cleft lip and palate. You see, both Helms and his 6-year-old daughter, Mia, were both born with cleft lip and palate. He has participated in the event for the last 6 years. This is the first year ROE has served as the event's title sponsor. The 2016 ROE Smile Train Triathlon, presented by Dr. Melissa C. Davidian, is a USA Triathlon sanctioned event. It was held June 26 at the Heritage Wake Forest area, starting with a 250-meter pool swim, a relatively flat 12-mile bike course out and back, followed by an out and back 5K. 100% of the athlete registration fees were donated to Smile Train. A total of 375 athletes participated in this year's event, and it garnered more than 60 volunteers. The event raised more than $27,000 for the charity, bringing the Smile Train Triathlon lifetime donation amount to $280,000. Women in Architecture Design join to aid scholarship fund. More than 100 people were present at the inaugural Chicks Dig It, that's Chicks spelled C-H-I-X, luncheon hosted by Bridgepoint Construction, celebrating women in the construction industry. The event was held at the new Mayton Inn in Cary and featured a panel of local female leaders representing the construction services from architecture, design, and general contracting. The event benefits the Bridgepoint Scholarship Fund, which provides financial support for women entering in the construction field. This year, NC State University's Department of Civil Construction and Environmental Engineering will receive the scholarship to benefit women in the construction management program. WRAL-TV anchor Deborah Morgan moderated the panel discussion. Angus Barnes Smalier on a taste run in Raleigh. There might have been one he hasn't tried. That was the thought Biz had in its head when the Angus Barnes certified wine sommelier, Hank Schweitmaker, was seen sipping wine at local Raleigh wine shop Uncorked. Schweitmaker was there for the high-end wine tasting on June 26, which featured 40 wines ranging from $35 to $80 from local distributors such as the Country Vintner, Advantage, and others. Schweitmaker was seen drinking wine with Katrina Weaver of Primary Residential Mortgage and Chris Morton of Keller Williams Realty. Biz wonders how many of these wines might eventually find their way to the Angus Barn wine cellar. Competitors in construction industry come together to support AHA's Hard Hats event. The American Heart Association's, or AHA, Triangle Chapter is getting ready for a new event this year, Hard Hats with Heart. AHA officials tell us the event is about uniting the construction industry around worksite safety and employee wellness. And local construction titans, Brassfield and Gorey and Skanska, are leading the effort for this year's event on September 8 at PNC Arena. Other local entities that will lend a hand include Clancy and Thays, LS3P, Johnson Controls, and DPR Construction, Biz was told. AHA's Hartball chairman, UNC Rex Healthcare president, Steve Burris, says the proceeds from the event will be rolled into the big gala early next year. Bob Ingram, Brexit good if you are vacationing there. Ask Bob Ingram about Brexit, and he'll tell you the market reaction is overstated. Ingram, a former London resident, used to head what would become GlaxoSmithKline, the British firm with its North American operational headquarters in Research Triangle Park. Additionally, Ingram, who is now a venture capitalist at Hatteras Venture Partners, was one of the biggest proponents for the London flight, once Raleigh-Durham International Airport's sole transatlantic service. While I'm sure this is a period of uncertainty for a lot of people, and as they think about this, I think reason will prevail over time, he says. But exchange rates are more uncertain. Ingram sees a stronger dollar in the near term, not only as it relates to the pound, but also the euro. On the other hand, it's good if you're vacationing or traveling, he says. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, new 480-unit luxury apartment complex breaks ground in North Raleigh. The developers of a proposed 480-unit high-end apartment community on Fox Road in North Raleigh hosted a groundbreaking ceremony on June 28, with plans to have the first units open by summer 2017. The new Foxwood luxury apartments will be located at 6701 Fox Road, north of Triangle Town Center Mall and Interstate 540. A developer team led by New York-based real estate investor Ken Burnham had purchased the former bank-owned 46-acre site in 2014. The group has been working on plans for the new apartment ever since. Burnham was also a developer partner in Lafayette Village, the European-inspired rental and office center on Honeycutt Road in Raleigh. All the units at Foxwood will come with a washer-dryer and gourmet-style kitchen. Amenities planned at the community include a 24-hour fitness center, resort-style pool, and a full business center. Each of the four-story buildings at Foxwood will also have interior elevator access. Duo expands firm to Charlotte. The Delta Gypsum Building Supply Company in Wake Forest is expanding into Charlotte for the first time following its acquisition of Charlotte-based United Materials. United Materials, like Delta Gypsum, specializes in the sale and delivery of drywall products and materials for the commercial and residential building industries and employs 19 people at its warehouse in Charlotte. Along with Delta Gypsum's six other warehouse and distribution locations in North Carolina and Tennessee, the combined company will employ about 120 people. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. John Kind, president of Delta Gypsum, says the deal was strategic for both companies. Our bandwidth is vastly expanded in our footprint, and a multitude of opportunities will open up as a result, he says. It's the equivalent of going from T1 to fiber in our sector of the distribution world. Partner in Chatham Park buys 650 acres across the Haw River for future housing development. Cary real estate investor Tim Smith, a partner in the same company developing the 7,200-acre Chatham Park community in Pittsburgh, has purchased another 647 acres of undeveloped land along the Haw River across from Chatham Park. The property, known as the Retreat at Haw River, had been approved for 395 single-family housing units in the mid-2000s after it was acquired by Charlotte-based Crescent Communities. Crescent, in 2006 and in 2008, paid a combined $14.5 million for the Haw River property, according to county records, but never broke ground on the project. Smith's company, a newly formed entity called Flying Crown Ranch LLC, paid $4.2 million for the land on June 10, Chatham County records show. The company name, he says, is a nod to the name of the ranch on Sky King, a 1950s-era TV western about an Arizona rancher, an airplane pilot. I guess I'm getting a little nostalgic, Smith quipped. Southern Season files Chapter 11, closing two stores. Chapel Hill-based Southern Season on June 24 filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, part of a restructuring strategy aimed at better achieving growth targets, a top executive said. The company is closing its largest format stores in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, and in Richmond, Virginia, which have opened in the past couple of years. The company instead will focus its attention on the expansion of its smaller store format called Taste of Southern Season. Taste already has locations at Cameron Village in Raleigh and in downtown Charleston, South Carolina. And additional locations are planned for Asheville, Wilmington, and Southern Pines. No changes are planned for its flagship store in Chapel Hill. Flower Power opens fourth location, sells first franchise, and that's Flower spelled F-L-O-U-R. A fourth location for Flower Power Kids Cooking Studio, a retail concept developed by Raleigh businesswoman Susan Caldwell, has opened at the Parkside Town Commons Shopping Center in Cary. Caldwell also confirms that the Cary location has been sold to culinary entrepreneurs Tammy and Dave Herr of Cary as the company's first franchise owners. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. Caldwell says negotiations are also underway to sell the Charlotte location to a new franchise owner, as well as one of her two locations in Raleigh at either North Hills or the Falls River Shopping Center. Whichever one she keeps in Raleigh, she says, will become a franchise training center for expansion of the brand throughout the Southeast. Lilly Pulitzer to open at North Hills. Lilly Pulitzer, the popular resort wear designer known for its year-round summer colors, will be expanding its brand even further into the Triangle with its first standalone retail store in Raleigh at the Main District at North Hills. The new Lilly Pulitzer store at North Hills is projected to open in 2017. The company also has a corporate-owned retail store at the Streets at South Point Mall in Durham. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, Rex shifts Wakefield plan on soft demand. UNC Rex Healthcare is not performing as many surgeries at its Wakefield hospital as projected. As a result, the hospital now wants to move an operating room from Wakefield to the main Rex campus off Lake Boone Trail. In 2014, Rex predicted it would see a steady increase of cases to nearly 3,900 in fiscal year 2019, something that would require more than 5,800 surgical hours and would fill capacity for three operating rooms. Now, however, the hospital system revised those numbers downward to fewer than 2,500 cases and less than 4,000 surgical hours. To meet that demand, two operating rooms are enough. The new lower projections come in part because of surgeons who left Orthopedic Specialists of North Carolina. Rex expected to see a steady flow of patients from that practice, though have now revised those estimates. Voicemails left with the executive director of OSNC were not returned. While it is likely that OSNC will recruit additional surgeons to replace these that have left, given the number of surgeons that are involved, it will likely take some time to replace this volume, according to the Rex application. Based on these changes, Rex does project less volume to shift from other facilities to Wakefield. North Carolina tightly regulates healthcare services and hospitals, and hospitals have a limited amount of licensed operating rooms. Because of the limit on operating rooms, hospitals treat these licenses like gold. Rex executives believe they can perform more surgeries and generate more revenue by moving the licensed operating room from Wakefield to the main campus. State regulators, through the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, must approve the project. Rex executives declined comment, citing the pending application. If approved, the main Rex campus would expand to 25 operating rooms. In Wakefield, Rex has a plan to transform the operating rooms from being hospital-based to being run as a joint venture. From a patient perspective, the change will be hardly noticeable. However, from the hospital's point of view, the change is significant. Technically, although the physical space will not change, the operating rooms will become the ownership of a separately licensed joint venture to be named Rex Surgery Center of Wakefield. That joint venture has not been formed, though Rex hopes to finalize the details of the new entity later this year or in early 2017. Veristat scopes for space to grow ops. Massachusetts-based clinical research organization Veristat will open an office in the Triangle and has a plan to expand to 150 or more local employees in the coming years. Already, the company employs 6 workers in North Carolina who work remotely, but will look to grow to 40 local employees by the time the office opens in the fall. Veristat has not finalized a lease, but it is looking for about 6,000 square feet. Veristat, which helps pharmaceutical, biotechnology, and medical device companies develop new drugs and medical tools, has been on a growth tear in recent years with the revenue growth of 175% from 2012 to 2015, according to data compiled by Boston Business Journal, a sister publication. Brexit not expected to hurt Sempra's European drug application. Chapel Hill drug developer Sempra has completed its application to market a next-generation pneumonia treatment in Europe. The finalized application comes on the heels of Sempra completing a similar application to market the drug, clarithromycin, in the United States. The recent referendum vote in the UK to leave the European Union over the next 2 years is not expected to affect the review of Sempra's submission. However, it has raised questions about future drug applications in Europe. And in a section called Quotable, the quote, additional access to adult chemical dependency beds will reduce strain on local emergency departments and general acute care hospital beds. And that is from Triangle Springs Mental Health Hospital in an application to open a drug treatment hospital. State regulators approved the application, and Triangle Springs will open the 77-bed hospital in Briar Creek. And finally, in a section called Big Numbers, 2 pharmaceutical companies with Triangle area subsidiaries made sizable product acquisitions. They include $742 million, What Chiesi, spelled C-H-I-E-S-I, USA Incorporated, the Kerry-based subsidiary of Italian pharmaceutical company Chiesi Pharmacy in Italian, could ultimately pay for cardiovascular products from the medicines company. The final price is dependent on royalty milestones. And $652 million. What Maine Pharma will pay in cash to acquire 37 approved drugs and 5 drugs pending approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration from Teva Pharmaceutical Industries Limited and Allergan. The Australian-based specialty pharmaceutical company operates a manufacturing facility in Greenville, where it recently embarked on a $65 million expansion project, which will expand its workforce to 460 employees. And now we turn to the On Tech and Transportation page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, FAA's new directive on drones opens regulatory process. Now that the Federal Aviation Administration has released drone regulations, the industry is ready for takeoff, and that means opportunity for North Carolina. Stephen Hartzell, an attorney at Brooks, Pierce & Raleigh, says that while there weren't any surprises in the FAA rules, there were a few tweaks from what FAA had initially proposed, such as lowering the pilot age to 16 from 17 and allowing for flights to be within 400 feet of a structure instead of just 500 feet above the ground. That means a contractor flying a drone over a 200-foot building to inspect a roof can fly an additional 400 feet over that structure. But the line-of-sight stipulation, which outlaws flying drones outside of your immediate sight line, means companies such as Amazon won't be able to make deliveries with the devices, at least not yet. This is really only the first step, he says. This is the first step where the FAA is incorporating the lowest risk UAS, unmanned aerial systems, into the national airspace system. He expects to see the FAA allow for lightweight drones to fly over people. Under the new rules, UAS cannot fly over people in the future. but the rule release is an important step. He says. He expects to see a drone bubble when it comes to entrepreneurship. Now that the exemption process isn't necessary for many applications, entrepreneurs will be looking to incorporate drones into their own businesses. And as bubbles often do, it will pop eventually. The industry is expected to boost North Carolina. The Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International has estimated the industry could create 1,200 jobs and $600 million in economic activity in North Carolina by 2025. Raleigh has one of the bigger drone manufacturer names with Precision Hawk. The company is working with the FAA to test technology that could allow pilots to fly drones outside of their sightline, research that could make Amazon's bullish delivery goals a reality. RDU's future? Only four concepts remain. Raleigh-Durham International Airport has narrowed nine concepts to four. While airport officials have nixed the idea of adding a completely new terminal, they've kept some bullish elements, such as with a plan that calls for an elevated transportation system to connect terminals 1 and 2 with a brand new transportation center. Nothing is final. Airport officials are still taking public comments in order to narrow the four plans down to one. The concepts developed by Recondo and Associates do all have common elements. Each plan would extend or replace current runways, and each plan would add a completely new runway to the west side of the airport. Additionally, the plans call for terminal extensions in order to add gates, both for international and domestic travel. The plans. The first of the four concepts presented, Alternative A, would mean extensions to both current runways and the addition of a new west side runway, in addition to terminal expansions and additions to Park RDU Central. A new ground transportation center off National Guard Drive would integrate rental car, public parking, and transit facilities. In addition to runway changes, Alternative B would see significant additions to Terminal 2 to accommodate additional international gates, as well as a new ground transportation center between the terminals. Alternative C would, in addition to runway work, add extensive additions to Terminal 2 and add a ground transportation center south of the terminal area. This plan also calls for a new elevated transportation system that would connect Terminals 1 and 2 with the new transportation center. The plan dubbed Alternative 4, in addition to runway work, calls for additions to Terminal 2 that would allow for more international aircraft gates, as well as gate additions to Terminal 1. Park RDU Central would be expanded, and a new ground transportation center would be added between Aviation Parkway and I-40. Red Hat execs gross $37 million in compensation. It was a good fiscal 2016 for wallets in Red Hat's executive suite. The Raleigh-based open-source software firm disclosed via securities filings that its executives were paid handsomely, especially its newest C-suite exec, CFO Frank Calderoni, who joined the company last year after a career at Cisco. Calderoni's compensation included a $4 million sign-on bonus and $500,000 in relocation funds. And here's a listing of the total executive compensation, including benefits. Jim Whitehurst, CEO, $12.7 million. Frank Calderoni, CFO, $15.4 million. Charles Peters, former CFO, $676,000. Arun Oberoi, Executive Vice President, Global Sales and Services, $5.3 million. Michael Cunningham, Executive Vice President and General Counsel, $3.6 million. And in a section called She Said It, we're now looking at doing up to the equivalent space of two more of these floors. And that's from Fran O'Sullivan, site lead for IBM's Research Triangle Park campus, on her plan to expand the agile office model that made its debut in the executive briefing building where she keeps her office. And finally, we have a section called Layoffs. For the third time this year, Xerox is making cuts in North Carolina. This time, the Connecticut Technology Services firm is cutting 53 positions in Raleigh, primarily pharmacist roles. Those impacted work at the Xerox State Healthcare Office. The company blamed the cuts on a business decision of a single client. Also this year, Xerox eliminated 139 positions in Henderson and 178 in Cary. The company said it had 4,800 employees in North Carolina. And we do have one general news story. Belk CEO to retire after PE buyout. And this is written by Jennifer Thomas. Belk Inc. CEO Tim Belk will leave the company less than a year after it was acquired in a $3 billion deal by New York-based Sycamore Partners. Belk, the third generation of his family to lead the Charlotte-based retail chain, has been CEO of the company since May 2004. Belk's board has named Lisa Harper, formerly chief executive officer of Hot Topic, as his replacement, effective June 28. Belk will work with her during the transition period in July before leaving the company. After managing through the ownership transition and filling a number of key management positions, I've decided this is an opportune time for me to retire as CEO of Belk, Belk said in a statement. He has been with the company for more than 35 years. He got his start pushing cartons on the warehouse docks in Gastonia. Tim Belk is a gifted leader who has taken Belk to new levels of success, said Bob Morgan, president and CEO of the Charlotte Chamber, in a prepared statement. He has positioned the organization to continue to succeed in the future. The Charlotte Chamber is grateful for the civic leadership Tim has provided as a former chair and for his continued engagement in the work of areas such as the Belk Foundation and the promotion of collegiate sports in our city. This marks the end of an era for the Belk family. Belk was the nation's largest family-owned and operated department store chain, with 293 stores in 16 southern states and a growing online presence. The company's first location opened in Monroe in 1888. Belk first announced its deal with Sycamore last August, and it was finalized in December. The Charlotte-based retailer is a wholly owned subsidiary of Sycamore. And in a section called He Said It, the quote, "There is a real S-curve, and we are still in the growing part of the S-curve, and when that inflects up is something I wish I knew." And that's from Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat, answering a question about when cloud computing platform OpenStack will be a material revenue contributor. The company announced inline net income of $92 million for the quarter, ended May 31. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal. And first we're reading the Viewpoint, a column written by Tom Sanders, who has taught finance at various universities and worked at several international banks. The headline of the column, "Now that Brexit is done, is Frexit next? Maybe Swexit?" More than half of the Brits voted June 23 to leave the European Union. What do they want? Their simple demands are not primarily Islamophobia or insular paranoia of losing their culture, as critical stay supporters describe those who won. The Vote Leave group wants to, 1, renationalize immigration policy away from the EU leadership in Brussels, 2, keep vitally needed immigration flowing into Europe but under controlled conditions governed by each nation state, 3, take some Syrian war refugees, but only after appropriate vetting and in controlled numbers. 4. Take a gradualist approach to economy-damming policies directed at man-made global warming, which in theory remains controversial to some, but costly to all British and European household budgets. British electricity is double the American cost. In short, the Leavers want the nation state back. The Leavers sought to rebuke EU bureaucrats for abusing the original idea of the EU as primarily an economic union promoting tariff-free trade, in order to use it as a tool to carry out what some think is an agenda for social, ethnic diversity, and environmental, man-made global warming agenda. Some say the only hope for continuance of the EU is to keep it strictly as an economic union, with many of its other features stripped away. This means a revocation of Schengen area. The Schengen Agreement of 1985 granted free movement of people and goods across 26 national borders without passport control. This was to be the first step in building a new United States of Europe, where you went where you pleased, as the Americans do. The Schengen has been a boon for cargo logistics. Unfortunately, now Syrian refugees who reach Greece or Italy also have freedom to move between any of the Schengen countries without papers or identification. Since no one even checks arriving war refugees, whole groups of terrorists can accompany desperate families fleeing the war in Syria. This is what the leavers want to stop. So there must be no more EU passport, no free movement of labor. Instead, immigration must face individual nation-state control. Efforts by the mostly Muslim Turks, who also have the largest number of Syrian refugees, about 2.2 million, to accede to the EU will be prolonged. In short, the leavers have lost confidence in the EU system in Brussels and their own national leaders. David Cameron, Prime Minister of Britain, is out. Being rebuked, Euro elites in the media and government now engage in scaremongering about the prospective fallout of the outvote. Their arguments are mostly economic. How can British trade face a common tariff against non-EU members? What happens to the British pound? Will the British economy shrink because of capital flight by investors who are using the island economy as a springboard for business into the continent? But such economic analysis seems premature, since the British are already contemplating a rethink second referendum on leaving the EU. Will others follow? Scotland now recontemplates leaving the United Kingdom in hopes of negotiating a special relationship with the EU. The Republic of Ireland, as an EU member, has huge trade with the UK. The Swiss application has withdrawn its application. There is even talk of Frexit, France. An EU without the UK, France, or even possible exiters such as Holland, Denmark, or Sweden? Unfortunately, the original common market plan of social, human, and economic integration did not contemplate the inundation by Islamics, nor did the original plan envision the extreme expense of reducing man-made global warming. So for today, keep the EU as an economic common market, reestablish the European nation-state, keep immigration environmental policy objectives out of the EU project, and greatly reduce EU bureaucracy and say so. That is what they want. And now also on the Viewpoint page, we're going to read the editor's notebook. And this is written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Perfect Time to Review Our Echo Devo Narrative. Sitting at Triangle Business Journal's Economic Development Forum on June 23 and listening to some of the area's most notable economic developers, I was left wondering whether we really are up to speed with the needs of today's businesses. The panelists talked about the process of economic development, how counties work with each other, and more importantly, how the state's newest economic development vehicle, the Economic Development Partnership, or EDP, works with the agencies. They all sounded informed, authentic, and believable. There was just one problem. They also sounded stale, and they sounded safe. Having listened in on scores of economic development forums almost every year for the past decade, I've heard almost everything. We keep talking about state government's role, importance of education and university partnerships, and the need to cater to all 100 counties in North Carolina. While all that sounds perfectly reasonable, as pointed out to the panelists and in my column last week, the metro areas overwhelmingly are creating the new jobs in this country. We were told that the state's economic development efforts are broken down in tiers, a metric also used to calculate economic incentives. So projects looking at Raleigh, Charlotte, Winston-Salem will have limited incentives than, say, companies looking at Hoke or Perquimans counties. Moreover, in order for the EDP model to work, the state puts in money and then the private industry puts in some more money. I believe that is a completely flawed system, and our legislators, economic developers, and the remoras that feed off the system are unwilling to change the process. While we must care about the entire state's well-being and needs, economic development simply is not the vehicle to do that. North Carolina's policy must be focused on areas that attract the most bites from corporations. The Metro Economies report released a few days ago makes it abundantly clear. Metros contributed 96.5% of all the new jobs since 2000. So if groups are going to ask private corporations for money to market our beautiful state, these private companies are going to ask for the ROI. Because last time I checked, progressive companies such as Google, Facebook, and Alibaba are finding their talent in areas that foster innovation, creativity, and discipline. Yes, those are the same companies that have their server farms in rural communities, but we all know the reason for that: low wages and energy costs. We must change this economic development narrative. The democratization of job and recruitment policy is a surefire way to mediocrity. And now we turn to the People on the Move page in the Triangle Business Journal. And the spotlight in this edition is on Trip Savory, president and COO of Curtis Media Group. For Trip Savory, a career that started as an account executive with Curtis Media Group in 1992, has now evolved into the role of president and chief operating officer of the company. Aside from a brief detour with another media company, Savory has spent his entire professional life climbing the ladder at Curtis Media Group. In his new role, he works closely with CMG founder and CEO Don Curtis to develop and implement the strategic vision and direction of the company. Savory's day-to-day responsibilities are to operate Curtis Media's Triangle brands, which includes programming, sales, hiring, FCC compliance, and community service. Curtis Media Group is a multi-platform media company with significant investments in local radio stations. It has more than 50 AM and FM signals across the state, including the Triangle, Triad, Boone, and Goldsboro markets. The company currently employs 250 people, about 100 of whom are located in the Triangle. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? If you surround yourself with talented people, it makes it so much easier to achieve your goals. I spend at least a third of my time recruiting, coaching, retaining, and growing superior talent. What are some of your major goals for your new position? We will continue to grow our current brands, and we also want to expand our footprint into new markets through acquisition as well as product innovation. Curtis Media Group has grown so much since I first started in Raleigh with WQDR and WPTF, and expansion is necessary to ensure our future success. Biggest pet peeve? Most people do not understand that listening to AM/FM radio is growing, not declining. Just in the past year, the Triangle radio audience, as measured by Nielsen, has grown more than 20% in actual listening. Biggest worry? That the big debt-laden national radio companies will continue to cut expenses and investments in order to make burdensome interest payments. Triangle area business person you most admire? Don Curtis, for his vision, his laser focus on the customer, and his entrepreneurial achievements. Family, wife Dolly, two children, Harrison and Hayden. Last book you've read? Factory Man by Beth Macy. And with our final minutes, we'll read as much as we can of Jim Verdonick's column in the small business section. Jim Verdonick is an attorney with Warden Smith Law Firm in Raleigh. The headline, In Pursuit of Freedom, This American Chose to Explore, Give. Every July 4th, I write about incorporating American values into our businesses. Usually I start with something from the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, but are these old documents still relevant to American values? I recently rafted the Grand Canyon to find out. What better way to learn whether Americans still value the unalienable rights that nature and nature's God endowed us with and that were self-evident to Jefferson's generation of Americans than spending a week with 30 fellow Americans and a Swiss ferryboat captain? on two insignificant pieces of rubber running the rapids that carved 277 miles of canyon through mile-deep rock. Let's talk about our entrepreneurial river guides, Greg, Andy, Sally, and Cowboy, who shared their grand home with 28 greenhorns. Because they had a simple business plan, go down the river, they didn't waste time on meeting about strategic direction. Rafts can't go up rapids and can't climb canyon walls. Starting the journey was a 277-mile commitment. America started with commitments by the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, who faced hangman's nooses if they lost the war for independence. Like America's founders, our guides gave us a few rules. Maintain basic sanitation practices, load and unload the rafts, and don't block their vision when running rapids. Except for these basic rules, we were free to pursue our happiness any way we wanted. So what happens when modern Americans are given this much freedom? Is it chaos or paradise? Who knows what someone else might do, but here's how one group of Americans used that freedom to pursue their happiness. GAKS, G-A-K-S, people inflicted gratuitous acts of kindness on one another, too numerous to count. Volunteering, twice each day we lined up to load and unload rafts, handing bags and other items from person to person. More people volunteered for bag line duty than were needed. One happy camper declared that the bag line was her favorite part of the trip. Group culture and acceptance. One large family and their friends constituted most of our group. The family adopted the rest of us, and their family culture became the prevailing culture of the expedition. And the last two were sophistication and nature. I'll skip ahead a little as we're running out of time. Of course, when we emerge from the canyon and rejoin life above the rim, we find a more complicated world, but we can improve that world if we apply the lessons we learned about how Americans behaved in 1776 and still do today when given the opportunity. Happy July 4th to us all, including the Swiss ferryboat captain. And we're going to stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.